This is the Horse Radio Network.
This is episode 208 of Horsemanship Radio, brought to you by Hands On Gloves, the all-in-one revolutionary bathing grooming gloves. Horsemanship Radio is a part of the family of the Horse Radio Network. Today, we have for you three famous gentlemen of horsemanship. This is Debbie Laux, and you're listening to the Horsemanship Radio. Thanks for joining us. Horsemanship Radio airs on the 1st and the 15th of the month, and I have my producer, Jen, with me today by voice, but soon to be right here with me, Jen. I can't wait.
Woohoo! We're closing in on the movement in a rapid pace.
Oh my gosh.
Remind me again the dates of the movement.
June 17 and 18 and 19.
17, now, 18, and 19.
You will be here on 16, I believe, and you guys are all piling into a big Airbnb in wine country. I'm so excited to hear about it. And then we will have you in. I'm going to put Glenn to work right away. Don't tell him that, because he thinks he's coming for a horse husband kickback. But since he doesn't have any, you know, talents and abilities like in the horsemanship side of it. He said that. I don't have any, so I don't have to do anything. I thought,
That's right. He's a horse husband, not a horse guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nope. We're going to put him to work. I've got something planned for him, too. You, on the other hand, get to chill out and wine in horse country and just take it all in because you're a horse girl.
I am going to investigate Flags Up Farms in Minutia, because it is such a lovely farm, and it's one of those great places that has so much history. The history oozes out of the trees and the fences and the walls, and I can't wait to just go walk around. So if you don't me around, it's because I'm investigating some nook or cranny or, yeah.
Good. Well, I'll give you a muck fork, too, you know, in case
there
me.
Work qualified. To do. Qualified there.
No, I want you to come here and just chillax. That's my
chillax.
My producer direction to you is please come in and relax. But we're going to have fun. We're going to have Templeton Thompson concert on Friday night, which I know you'll be whooping it up in the front of the audience there. But it's kind of an intimate thing, though. We've never had a concert at the event before. And, you know, we've limited it, unless people talk me into it in the next few weeks, we've limited it to 50 participants. And then again, we have about 10 presenters all told. And that's a pretty intimate group for Flag. For example, Monday, we had a corporate event here for a corporation called Voya, and there was 170 people for lunch, Jen.
Wow!
that's active. There's a lot of people worming around here. But this, on the other hand, this is for horse lovers and people who really want to come hear some amazing horse trainers, I would call them horse advocates, but we're not political here. We're really more about how can we be better for our horses? How can we be better for our horses?
Well, yeah, I think your horses, because horsemanship, Flag Is Up, Monty Roberts University are very much set an example.
Thanks.
You push the message forward. You push the mission forward by walking the walk and talking, not just talking the talk. Versus an advocacy group is all about pushing the mission, not necessarily about doing it. So you help people learn the skills and understand the theories and the science so that they themselves can practice it, and they themselves can practice it so that others see it and want to join, right?
Very kind. Yes. That's the mission right there. You summed it up. Because if your horses are not actually showing it, then we're not doing it.
So, yeah, right. And if it's not just where you got, it's how you got there.
Yeah.
It's great and fabulous to be well-known or to have a lot of followers or to have a lot of awards. All those things are great, but how you got there is more important than where you got to.
Thanks.
Right?
Well, and I think, yeah.
You guys help every horseman, regardless of what level they are or will be, get there in a way that benefits the horse and the human and the culture that surrounds them both.
Yeah, well, horses deserve that. Yeah, I know. I'm going to write that down. It's good. No, it's really nice. It's really nice. And I think that's why we had the three men on today that we had for this episode, because they're, in each case, they're all pretty famous, these guys.
They got to amazing places and are still getting to more amazing places. Mm-hmm. But how they got there.
They got there. They earned it for sure, but they put the horse first. I would say 100% they put the animal first. And that's why we invited them on, right, Jen?
That's right. And before we get to our guests, we've got three of them.
I wanted to mention something. The title sponsor of the Horsemanship Radio Show is Hands on Gloves.
Yes.
Yes. And I wanted to mention one of the many, many uses of the hands-on gloves. First of all, they come in two hands. There's nothing worse than having a grooming tool you can only use with one hand. And most grooming gloves are either right or left. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I have a big horse. By the time I get halfway through that horse, I've got the left side groomed. I need to switch hands.
That's true.
I'm sorry, I need to switch hands. So I like having two hands. But also, because the little knobblies are on each and every fingertip, including your thumb,
right,
you can get the nooks and crannies. And in the springtime, the horses start to get sweaty, but they still have plenty of hair. Yeah. So you get that greasy, cruddy stuff in the nooks and crannies. Yeah. And on their cannons, or in that little dent above the bulbs of their heels.
Yeah.
And things like that.
Yeah, that gooey.
Yeah. Yeah. But if you have your hands on gloves, you can scrub around in those little nooks and crannies so they don't get the greasy, gooey stuff that makes their hair fall out. Preventative grooming.
You know, you're such a good parent. That sounds awesome. Chris McCarron won his first of two Belmont Stakes in 1986 with Danzig, unexpectedly defeating that year's Kentucky Derby winner and Preakness runner-up, Ferdinand. Some people will remember Ferdinand. The next year, Ali Sheba and McCarron won the first two legs of the Triple Crown. Ali Sheba and McCarron returned the next year to win six Grade One races. And Ali Sheba was dubbed America's Horse and the title of the world's richest horse. McCarron retired as a jockey after 28 years in racing in 2002. Since then, he has served as an advisor and actor in the film Seabiscuit. He's held the position of vice president and general manager at Santa Anita Park, worked as a racing analyst for TVG Network, and launched the North American Racing Academy. Now he has taken up the causes for horses, and he joins Monty today to discuss the future of racing. So I wanted to get started by putting you two together, because I know in common you have right now a lot of time with Marty Irby. And Marty and several other people have been real busy being advocates for horses and horse racing. But I did, Chris, want to have everybody get a little background on you too, because you've been a legend on the racetrack. Monty, I will say, has been a legend off the racetrack, getting those horses ready for talented people like you to ride. And I'm glad you mentioned Griffin. And is he still riding? You still giving a few lessons to this boy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I don't give him the lessons. His mom does.
Okay.
She's a show hunter jumper show horse trainer. She's got about between ponies and full size horses. She's got about 22 horses that she's got under her care right now.
Goodness sakes, that's awesome! That's awesome. Yeah. Well, we did tell the audience to introduce you that you had created and founded the North American Riding Academy, the only school where aspiring jockeys can earn a college degree. That's impressive. And that you started that in 2006, and it's in Lexington, Kentucky, but it's carried on since 2014. You've put it off in good hands then, and you're a record-breaking jockey. And I thought, who better than you two to discuss what's going on in the racing right now and how we can help the horses. And let's talk a little bit today about that exciting Kentucky Derby that just happened too. Monty, Dad, hi. I'll let you kind of jump in here too and lead the way, because I know there's a lot of synergy between you two, but you don't always get to get on the phone together. So I thought that might be fun.
Yeah, that's great. I I really enjoy being around Chris and talking to Chris, and it hasn't happened for a long time. We have gone our separate ways, me getting a lot older than he is. My grandsons, I don't sit with them anymore because they're in their 30s and they've got their own businesses. But Chris, the recent Derby stirred up a lot of conversation, and I had some phone calls and stuff. And there was a tendency throughout the United States, I guess, to really get opposed to the guy who was trying to keep the horse from eating his pony and his leg. And my position was that most people that would blame him for anything that he did at that point have never been in that position before. And you do what you can do. He feared for his life, and he feared for his horse's life, too. That's my opinion. Anyway, what do you think about it?
Yes, I couldn't agree more, Monty. Greg Blasi is a very good horseman. He's a great outrider. He has saved a lot of he has prevented a lot of serious accidents from happening on the track, both in the morning and the afternoon. And I know the jockeys and the exercise riders rely greatly on his expertise to keep things as safe as he possibly can out there in the racetrack. I felt really bad for him reading the social media in the days after the incident, because that horse, that colt, was on fire, and he wanted to tear Greg up and the pony too. And colts can get that way. And I was interested to read a fascinating fact that was posted somewhere. I can't remember exactly where, but the amount of pressure that a horse can provide with his bite is over 500 pounds per square inch.
I know.
It's stronger than a pit bull. So, you know, obviously, you know, when I saw the bruises and the cuts on Greg's body from the horse biting him, I was astonished. And oh my goodness, no wonder he had to be so aggressive. He had to just fend that colt off. And I somewhat put a little bit of blame on the jockey, Sonny Leong. Not completely blame him, because he's still a young rider. I would guess that he's not been in that kind of position before. But if I was on that horse, if I was on Root Strike, once that colt started demonstrating such aggression, I would have told Greg, turn me loose. Just let me go. I'll be able to handle it from over here, you know? And I know what was in the back of Greg's mind. No, actually not the back of his mind, but the forefront of his mind. He had to keep that horse close by so that Donna Barton on the pony could do the interview for NBC.
Right.
That is standard protocol. And I know most people like to hear the comments from a jockey in the immediate aftermath of a race. When tensions are flying high, whether they're good or bad, the audience wants to hear what happened. And, they were not able to get much of an interview done because of the colt's antics. But, Greg.
Well, I have to tell you that I completely agree with what you just said, right up and down, including, and I would say the most important thing that you said was this was a young jockey. And you can blame the jockey if you want, but he's a young jockey that probably never was in that position before. There's a high probability that he wasn't. And you would be asking him on the corner of the street somewhere, hey, those two guys are in a knife fight. I want you to come in and help me get him loose. And he might say to you, get out of here. I'm not going into two guys in a knife fight. And basically that's that's what he did. Now, I agree with you that, A, I think the outrider might have turned him loose and did it, but then he's responsible for what happens when that horse leaves him, too. And you make a point that he is a responsible guy. He tried to do his best, and the last thing he needed was complaints about what he did, because if you're going to complain about what he did, then you do it from a standpoint of, I've been there before and this is what I did, you know? And I have witnessed the pressure of a horse's jaw on about three different occasions in my time working with these remedial horses. And I have to tell you, it is fearsome and it's all encompassing. Your brain just kind of goes blank and you just save yourself any way you can. And having said that, I watched the video several times, and I have to tell you, Chris, if you know these people, I would like them to know that I could fix this horse, and I could fix him in 5 to 6 days, and they could race him anywhere they wanted, and they would not experience this problem another time, in my opinion. I can only say that I believe that because I've done it several times before. Mm-hmm. Two horses in Germany, and two or three in England, and a couple in the United States, where I have fixed these before. And it's a kind of an unusual fix, and you have to give me about 5 or 6 days, and I have to have some technical people to fix, build things for me. But I could fix this horse where that particular pony could go catch him after a race and go right up, and he would come and put his nose on the pony's neck and never act out the way he did there. I could do it. And if you could let those people know that, I believe they probably scratched him from the Preakness because they didn't have it straight yet and they weren't sure about it. Do you know, Chris, did the horse ever do this before that, do you know of?
I don't really know. First, let me say that I have no doubt in my mind that any remediation protocol that you would employ in trying to get a horse like that straightened out, I have no doubt in my mind that you could do it. I would guess and say it wouldn't take you 5 days. You'd do it quicker than that. But I'm not really familiar with these people. I know of Eric Reed. I've never met the man. The only sort of distant relationship I have with him is that when one of my graduates started riding many years ago, Eric Reed was one of the first trainers that had runners, you know, live horses, and offered Ben, my student Ben Creed, great opportunities in riding horses for him. They won some races together, but that's as close as any kind of relationship I have with him. Like I said, I've never met him, but you know, as far as dodging the Preakness, they came out early on, right after the race. They mentioned that, you know, had the colt run well in the Derby and was not, you know, embarrassed by any stretch of the imagination, that they would most likely skip the Preakness and go on to the Belmont, because there's just not enough time between the Derby and the Preakness being only 14 days. I was happy. You know, I was proud of them to stick to their guns and forego any temptation of, you know, going for that Triple Crown when they felt in their hearts that it was not in the colt's best interest.
Yeah, well, I certainly can't say that they did it because of this, but I had a feeling they did. And I promise you that what you don't know about them and you're not having been associated with them before, they know about you. And they would trust your word. If you want to get word to them that I'm retired from traveling, and COVID and everything else, my age and everything is keeping me from traveling, but I would be happy to go to Kentucky. I would, the 5 or 6 days is a lot to do with the technical things I need made so that everybody's safe. And yeah. They have to make up these things for me that I would use to protect everybody. And I know that it would take 15 or 20 days for him to get loving what he's doing and not even thinking about being vicious. It would take a little time for that. But once I got them lined out, the owners and the people involved, once I got them lined out, then they would see the value of it and continue to help the horse come along. I feel sure of that. And it's a real shame. But one of the best horses I ever had in my life attacked me while I was on another gelding. And my position is that he was attacking the gelding, but he got a hold of me just below the left side, just below the ribs, and shook me like a sock in the air, and then threw me about 20 feet away and continued to attack the gelding. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, there were some sleepless nights trying to figure that one out. But when I got him fixed, there was never that problem again.
Yeah. Wow.
I'd love to ask you too. Yeah, horses are powerful, and we don't want to forget that. But I think it was a testosterone moment. It was the heat of the moment too, to give the horse a break. But I also like to talk to you too about a little bit about what's going on right now. I know Animal Wellness Center and Chris, you've been working with some of the people to about drugs in racing, and I'd love a little update, a little a primer on what's going on now, and if there's anything that anybody could do to call whoever they need to call, or you know, if there's anything we can do as public to help support whatever you're supporting. We know you're trustable and doing good things for us.
Oh well, thank you, Debbie. As far as an update, the only update that I can offer is from what I've read online with regard to the HISA Act, mm-hmm. that's HISA, Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act. Now, I had previously made about 7 trips up to Washington, D.C. with Marty and others who were trying to get this bill passed. And we spent time walking the halls of Congress trying to get co-sponsors for the bill. And fortunately, we were successful. It only took about 7 or 8 years, but
yeah.
we got it done, and President Trump signed it. And so it's that was all good. But I have been adamant in my position of horses running medication-free. I've been that way for a long time. And I was so elated when Leader McConnell, Mitch McConnell, who's from Louisville, Kentucky, he finally endorsed the HISA bill. And when he did that, President Trump was only too kind to sign it. But my stance on drugs and racing is strong. I feel steadfast in the belief that it has to be a level playing field for the sake of the horses, for the safety and sake of the horses, that they're running completely drug free, that if they have any ailment, if they have any kind of aches or pains anywhere, that they're going to feel it without those symptoms being disguised by pain relief medications. It creates a safer environment for the jockeys, of course, because when the horses are safer, the jockeys are going to be safer. When the horses are not racing in a safe, sound environment, then the jockeys are at risk as well. Mm-hmm. So therein lies the reason for my feeling to offer my input. And mm-hmm. when I testified in front of Congress, a couple of years ago, I expressed that to the legislators in the chamber that I'm coming here from a jockey's point of view. If the horses are no longer going to refund medication, it automatically creates a safer environment for the jockeys. Mm-hmm. And so the biggest sticking point was Lasix. It seemed like the trainers, for the most part, and owners as well, were okay with doing away with any kind of anti-pain medication, but they wanted to keep Lasix available. But that is now being phased out.
Great.
The Breeders' Cup does not allow any horses to race on Lasix.
Great.
And it's been this way for a little while now, almost 2 years, I think, for 2-year-olds. They cannot race on Lasix, but the older horses were being grandfathered in. Mm-hmm. And so the interesting thing for me is the war cry that was coming from a lot of the trainers around the country, and again, some owners, was that without Lasix, these horses are going to bleed through mm-hmm. their nostrils. They will experience epistaxis, which is when the lungs begin to fill with some blood, and then the blood actually drips out the horse's nostrils. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a frightening scene. Sure. You know, it's terrible when that happens. But there has not been very many at all.
Yeah.
Of that, at least none that I can see that have been reported. So the phase out of Lasix is working very well. And thank God they can no longer race on any kind of anti-pain medication.
Right. I don't like to conjecture like this, but I'll throw a question out to you. Do you think Lasix was covering other things? Is there a reason that they were so adamant about Lasix for so long?
That is something that went by the wayside some years ago.
Okay.
Because of the improvement in the process of testing with these various testing labs throughout the country, they were able to uncover, if you will, any kind of anti-inflammatory or anti-pain medication, despite the fact that horses were treated with Lasix. It used to be that Lasix would cause the horse to urinate so much that they would actually flush out some of the underlying other medications that were administered to the horse. Mm-hmm. But the testing procedures have been so perfected that, Medina Spirit is a prime example. He was found to have, well, I think, 14 picograms, which is a billionth of a gram, mm-hmm. Which is certainly not performance enhancing, but the rule states that he can have no medication in the system whatsoever.
Right.
I think the trainers were sincerely concerned of a lot more horses were going to experience epistaxis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know you've been pretty vocal about whips and racing for a while now, a long time. And I know that you and Monty, I think, let's talk about that. Do you have a position on whips at this point, Chris? What's the evolution of whips in racing in the U.S. now?
I'm really happy with the progression of minimizing the use of the whip. I actually prefer to call it riding crop, but I guess it's semantics.
Right.
But you know, I am not in favor of taking it away altogether. A case in point would be if I was on Rich Strike and he was attacking Greg and his pony in that fashion, I absolutely would have used my riding crop to get his attention. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would have just smacked him on the shoulder in on the part of his body where I could not inflict any bruising or any cuts or anything. You know, I would have used it. The noise that the popper makes when it makes contact with the horse hide is loud enough at times that it would certainly get a horse's attention. Mm-hmm. So for safety purposes, I'm all in favor of the jockeys carrying a crop But I love the fact that most racing jurisdictions in this country and abroad have put a limit on the number of stripes a jockey can do.
And how are we doing in the world right now? Do we compare with most countries, or how's that going?
You know, I'm not too sure. I don't know the rules in Japan. I'm a little bit familiar with the rules in the UK, where it's I believe it's six strikes. You cannot hit more than once in succession. You have to, if you're going to use the crop. I know in California, I'm bouncing around here, but in California, you cannot cock the stick. You have to leave it in the down position, and you cannot hit a horse more than twice in succession. You have to, if you hit the horse, you have to give him an opportunity to respond favorably. And but it's a limit of six, which I think is very fair. It's fair for the jockeys, and I think it's a lot kinder, you know, for the horses. The one thing about the riding crop, though, you know, I have ridden lots of horses that would sort of, when they get to the lead, they start waving on the other horses. I like to use the analogy of a national football player, whether he's a running back or a receiver, and he's got like 4 or 5 yards on the defender, and he's running down the field to score a touchdown, and he starts showboating. He looks back and slows down, and he struts across the line. Well, I rode a little horse many years ago called Ali Sheba.
Yes, you did.
That same exact thing.
Oh.
Ali Sheba would wait on his company. He would get to the lead. I could actually feel him decelerate. And he would just say, I don't have to win by 3 lengths. I can win by a neck and everybody will be happy. Well, he gave me fits sometimes, Debbie.
Yeah.
Come
that
on,
would be
don't
scary.
Slow down now.
Almost there. Yeah.
And so in those circumstances, you know, the riding crop used for encouragement can be a useful tool.
Gotcha. And do you ever hear about races that could go whipless? I mean, would it be a fun example maybe to throw some money at some purses where everybody tossed the whip and just saw, you know, level playing field, as you like to say earlier? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there is some precedent to that.
Okay.
Monty could correct me. He might know a little bit more about the European rules, but I know in Norway, the jockeys are not allowed to carry a crop except for, get this, 2-year-old races. they can carry a stick in 2-year-old races, but they cannot in the older classifications. The opposite happened in this country some years ago when Santa Anita went back to starting 2-year-old racing in early April, and it was 2 furlongs, a quarter mile at Santa Anita, and the jockeys were not allowed to carry a riding crop. They had to use their hands. They would yell and scream and chirp and cluck and, you know, be very oral with their commands. And they could, you know, take the rein and slap it on the horse's neck and so forth to get him to extend his stride. But crops were not allowed. So Norway looks at it one way, and, you know, the California Racing Commission looks at it a different way.
Yeah. And Monty, give us your European perspective.
Well, Norway is the only one that says absolutely not. And, you know, I was there and on the change, and they went my way, my suggestion, but it was the trainers that said, well, the 2-year-old has to be shown how to go and you need to use it, you know. But actually, the jockeys aren't using it very much, and some of them just leave the darn thing in the room and go ride the race without it at all. Because it has been proven that the 2-year-old is more likely to have a problem from being struck with a whip than he is to do a good job when being struck with a whip. It frightens them. They duck sideways. And just like Chris says, then the jockey isn't safe. Mm-hmm. And It's been a real transition for me to watch. And when I came to England, boy, a lot of the trainers say, oh, he's going to come around here now and tell us that we can't hit the horses and stuff like that. And then I say what I say, and I'm not dictating to anybody. And they started trying a little less of the stick. And one of the things that I'd like to say about the stick is I would like to see larger diameter and softer surface. Mm. These little, small diameters with hard woven material, they're the stinging little cutting things. But a large one, even wrapped in cloth and then leather over it, with larger diameter and that popper, as Chris says, that will, no pain, but it will cause the horse to flush and try again, and he listens to it better than a little stinging whip. And they can throw it away when they weigh in. They started talking about, well, if we weigh in with the whip, then we don't want those big round whips. But I had some being tried in England that were upwards of 5/8 of an inch in diameter and softer surfaces and a large popper on them. And, you know, they worked pretty darn well. Debbie, you would know, but very few people do, about my giddy up rope.
Right. Yeah.
And it's made of cotton yarn and braided, and it just goes woof, 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 but it doesn't sting. And horses will respond forward with that way better than a stinging whip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a visual stimulation as much as anything, too. They see behind a little bit and oof. Yeah, those are fun. And I love that you're having a conversation about these things instead of just, each generation picking up what the last generation gave them, questioning everything and making it better for the horse. And you are two grand examples of what has happened in the evolution in racing in the last 10 years or so. I have no doubt that people will listen to this and cheer you on and give you other good ideas too that you can become champions for. So I appreciate you both, what you're doing for horses out there and for the next generation, i.e. Griffin and your grandson. And I hope he's doing well, and we will love following him, even if he becomes a violinist. It's okay. That's right. But we hope he sticks with horses. We need more boys in horses, that's for sure. But not in the racing as much. And so I'm really proud of what you both are doing, and I'm really pleased and happy to have you on Horsemanship Radio. And I hope we can have you back when new news comes out.
Imagine if you could take Monty to the barn with you. Watch and learn as he addresses each challenge with your horse and answers your questions too. You head to the arena and you work on each new lesson, knowing Monty's there to encourage you, all with violence-free, tried and true methods. After all, he's been helping train horse lovers all his life. With his online university, you could be like Kathy, a retired teacher who just brought her first horse.
Recently, I went to a tack shop to look for a smaller halter. I'm 61, just purchased my 14-hands POA the day after my birthday, just a few weeks ago, after never having had a horse. And yes, that's crazy, but as a retired teacher who never had a hobby other than teaching, I decided to go for it. My hubby and I have taken lessons this past year, but I really longed for a relationship with a horse. The only other experience I'd ever had was to ride a horse in Philly, Pennsylvania, my hometown, when I was 16, and I got bucked off. And that was it until I was 61. Well, the owner of this tack shop, this precious lady, 84-year-old lady, gave me a copy of this magazine, Equine Monthly. And the article I read in it was Horses Are Biofeedback Beings, and it was just so interesting. I really felt like I just found a pot of gold when I read it, because in it, it talked about Monty's online university and that I could have access to 575 videos for $10 a month. And before that, I was just searching YouTube for everything I could find. But truthfully, that's just a pain. I love that the uni videos are concise and they're in order. They have extra notes and a quiz, and I just can't thank you enough for the huge blessing of your online university. It really has changed my life, and I will never be the same. I've had my horse Jack now for 7 weeks, and thanks to the videos, I've done join up with him, and it really worked like a dream. I had to do it in an arena, but it still worked, thanks to Monty's lessons and the cues and the hand signals. The ability to watch the lessons over and over on demand is incredible. So I also want to thank you so very much for making the online university affordable for this retired teacher. Thank you so much for all that you do for everyone who really wants to love a horse. Kathy.
Dr. Marty Becker has always had compassion for and a deep love of all animals. He's now leading an amazing group of dedicated professionals on the Fear Free Advisory Group, with a goal of changing the entire ecosystem of many animals, starting with dogs, cats, and other companion animals. Fear Free was founded by America's veterinarian, Dr. Marty Becker, and he developed hundreds of experts in behavior, medicine, and handling. Fear Free has become one of the single most transformative initiatives in the history of companion animal practice. Well, welcome, Dr. Marty Becker. I'd like to start with your horsey background. How'd you find some horses in your life?
Oh, this is interesting. So I grew up on a family farm in southern Idaho down in potato country, and it was like the ark unloaded there. I mean, we had beef cows, we had dairy cows, we had sheep, we had goats, we had chickens, we had pigs. We didn't have horses.
Oh.
And the reason was my dad had been injured on a horse when he was young and had us terrified. And he wasn't terrified of really anything except horses. So my experience with horses was very limited. And I went to veterinary school and saw a variety of horses there. There were two racetracks in Washington at the time. So with one of the surgeons doing surgeries on called wobblers with cervical instability in the neck and doing a pretty revolutionary procedure. And I remember spending all night one night with two draft horses that had gotten into the grain. You know, they were planting grain and they tore up the sacks and foundered. And I met my wife, and my wife, Teresa, she was one of the first pictures of her. Her dad was putting up a homemade kind of horse in the basement on these giant springs, and he hadn't hooked it to the ceiling yet when she jumped on it. And she's got a picture of her with two black eyes.
Oh.
And then it was briar horses, and then it was a pony, and then it was horses. And so when I got married to my incredible wife, Teresa, 45 years ago, that's what started it. And through her, she always had a knack with horses. And so, you know, that fear that was built into me, being with a racehorse with cervical instability is not the best introduction to a horse when they can, you know, crash into
challenge.
You and are not exactly like the quarter horses we have now. Yeah. And then my daughter came along, and she's just like her mom. She, anything you could do, I'd never do these crazy dares, like jump off an 8-story bungee jump. If you do, you ride horses. And she did it all. And then she became, they got into showing Western pleasure. So we live on a horse ranch called Almost Heaven Ranch.
Yeah.
And this is a funny story. My wife, you know how there's a Western pleasure, there's like $100,000 down to like a $25,000 horse. You can't run NASCAR with a Volkswagen Beetle. And so we had like the introductory bottom level horse, and Teresa and Mikkel rode the same horse, and Teresa won absolutely nothing. No ribbons, no sashes, no belt buckles. And Mikkel won everything, and she became the 4-time Canadian national champion.
No way. 4-time.
So that was it. You know, then I had a coffee cup that said, "They nay, I pay." I didn't realize that there were costumes for Western pleasure that made Vegas look tame. And then all the regalia and the 4-horse feather light and the 2-horse feather light trailer and then the pickup. And so, but it was, it ended up just being trail riding, you know, just trail riding in the care of horses. And now I can honestly say my favorite thing to do in the morning is go out and take care of the horses.
Nice. Yeah. You're the perfect horse husband. You are ideal. When you look it up in the dictionary, guess what? I mean, you've got a vet that you sleep with. That's good, right?
Well, you know, the guy that used to come out and take care of our horses, I'm still a little timid around horses as far as the medical care. I've had two classmates killed with horses.
Really?
And it was just a freak thing. But out of the 73, two had some freak accidents. And, you know, I want somebody to come out that sees a lot more horses than I do. Yeah. I'll do the routine things. But the veterinarian used to come out was my wife's old high school boyfriend. Oh. And so I thought that was pretty interesting. And that's just this thing for veterinarians. But I'll tell you, since Fear Free started, you know, this movement started to reducing fear, anxiety, and stress in animals. And it started in dogs and cats and then went to avian. And the latest one was for equine. And, you know, being a prey animal, we know how fear, anxiety, and stress can affect them. And
yes.
Now you look at it with different eyes. You know, when I see a horse that's in a stall all the time that has fear, anxiety, and stress, or I see a horse that is terrified of the farrier or the veterinarian or other things along the trail, you start to understand, you know, you start to understand what causes it. And, yeah. And just like a dog, you know, I've had some traumatic incidences in my life with a dad that was manic depressive and an alcoholic. And I can talk about those things and you can ferret it out, but with a horse, you don't know everything that's happened in their life. And so some of it's a mystery, and some of the things, like we had a horse recently we put on a product. It's just a milk protein. And this horse went from being very anxious to just having that added to their feed. And they are like happy as a Walmart greeter now. Yeah. Really happy.
Always smiling.
Yeah,
that is awesome. That was one of the things I was going to ask you today about tips. I know that when we look at vet schools today and the demographic of the students that are in there, it's getting to be difficult to find those students that grow up with large animals. And I'm wondering if vet schools, and you may not know this, but if vet schools are adapting to that, how do young veterinarians get experience with these larger animals? And is it a positive? The Fear Free program, I want you to define for us a little bit, because it sets the tone for what we want to talk about today, from fearful to fear free. And that is a positive program to free these animals from anxiety and fear. And you have begun certifying a lot of people. We should go through some stats on that. And then eventually what I'd like to do is come back to, how do we know if a veterinarian, you know, is prepared for a large animal or not these days when they come out of vet school? So start with Fear Free. We know that you're famous and we know that you're an amazing veterinarian. Where did you see that need and how did you launch it?
Well, I'm closing in on 70 years old. Not quite as old as your dad, but I'm getting there. He's got a few years on me, my friend. My friend Monty. But, you know, I was at a lecture by a boarded veterinary behaviorist in Canada. And I had given the keynote the day before, and she was in the front row and giving me all sorts of smiles. You know, you look at an audience and there's a little burst of positivity here. Then you look at somebody else in the audience that seems to like it. You get a little burst there. And so the next day I thought, well, I better go to her talk. She gave the keynote the next day, except I sat in the back of the room and I engaged her as she came to the door, but planned on leaving. As soon as she got engaged with some people, I was going to sneak out and grab a beer and meet my wife early for supper. And her talk changed my life. She talked about fear is the worst thing a social species can experience, and it causes permanent damage to the brain. That those of us in veterinary medicine, we're causing repeat severe psychological damage to pets by what we were doing or not doing. That fear is caused by something painful or disturbing. And she used an example of a dog, and this could be a horse as well, but she used the example of a dog getting their nails trimmed. And that's, if they trim too short, it's painful. Now, when they see the nail trimmers, or they're taken into the part of the house where they've had their nails trimmed, or that drawer opens up, that's disturbing. And with a syringe, you know, a blood draw, a vaccination, injection of antibiotics, that's painful. Now, when they see the syringe, that's disturbing. And she went on to describe how all animals were the equivalent of a 1-year-old child. They're taken against their will. She called it hell care. They have no idea why the procedure benefits them. They can't anticipate or expect the relief of fear, anxiety, and stress or pain, even if it's moments away. And they can't flee the threat.
Right.
And she said, who in this audience was born in the 50s and 60s that remember being taken to healthcare where you were manhandled, manipulated, threatened, and abused? I thought,
yeah.
Okay. I looked at my finger and I remember three people holding me down at the doctor's office to take a sliver out. Oh. I remember one time getting an injection and crying out in pain. It hurt, probably 50s era penicillin. Mm. My mom rose up out of her chair and raised her hand above her head and goes, shut up, Marty. She goes, don't embarrass the doctor. That was the comfort I got in 1960.
Yeah.
And then my sister Cheryl used to get her ponytail pulled at the dentist's office to keep her mouth open like a human Pez dispenser.
Oh.
So let me give you an example. We go get a flu shot or a COVID shot. We know why it benefits us. We know why it benefits it. We know that it takes 30 minutes or less. The actual jab is 15 seconds. And at any time, if we want, we can leave. We can flee the threat. When a horse gets a vaccination, they're against their will taken to get the vaccination. They have no idea why it benefits them. They don't know how long this procedure, when it's going to end, and they can't flee the threat. So what they see is danger. And often, sadly, a lot of these animals actually think they're going to be killed. They show all the brain signs, the same thing they do when it's that kind of brain activity to get right for you, what we call sometimes collapsing immobility, where they just freeze. It won't move. A frozen cat on the table, or a dog that's laying there like it's sleeping, but it's not. Or a horse that seems like, well, that horse is really calm. They actually think they're just about to die.
Shut down. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like flooding. Yeah.
Like flooding. Yeah. Like exactly like flooding. And you know, it's funny talking about my classmates. Most of us were farm kids. We'd all seen live births. We'd all seen death. We'd all seen all sorts of animals. And today, 60% of the profession is female and 80% of the veterinary school students are female.
Yeah.
And most of them have not seen a live birth. You know,
is that right?
They don't see a litter of puppies or kittens being born, or they don't, you know, they're not out seeing calving season or a foal. And often it's funny. I've got a little dog that's 6 years old named PewDiePie, and he came up on it's called Wings of Rescue from Southern California. There's eight doctors in the practice where I work at, and not a single one of them except me had ever seen a case of distemper.
Wow.
And we all know about distemper in dogs, but
pretty easy.
Pretty easy. They'd never seen it.
Crazy. So, mm-hmm. And that's one stat I was going to ask you about today too, is the growing in women in these professions too. It's in horses. It's super pervasive, as you know, but also in medicine. But if you explain a little bit about fear-free, I think what we're going to find possibly is that you don't need the strength and size and everything. You just need the experience and the education, right?
Actually, the veterinarian I spoke of that was my wife's old boyfriend, we won't mention his name. I don't want to give wrong. I'm joking. He's actually a friend of mine. But you know what? There's now, this almost sounds made up, but he was a solar practitioner for a long time. Now there's five doctors there. And the veterinarian that we use there is a female named Dr. Gentle. Like, wouldn't that be amazing to have a name, Dr. Gentle, that's a veterinarian? She's fun to tease about that. But Roland was all about manhandling. He was all about restraint. I mean, it's a twitch. It's riding the halter up in the air like a equine elevator when it reared up in the air and never even stopped talking. And, you know, horse moves a little bit, a good old kick in the sides would never hurt anything, you know.
There you go.
It was kind of his attitude. And so he'd use large bore needles. And the horses would see his truck. He's very loud. The horses would see his truck and they just run for the back 40.
Yeah.
And Dr. Gentle has kids that make these molasses horse cookies. And when she sometimes just drives by and pulls in and gives the horses these little molasses cookies and drives off. So she'll draw a vaccine or an antibiotic up with one needle. She changes for a brand new needle that's sharp. Yeah. Uses a smaller bore needle. She always, she approaches them differently. It's called the considered approach. And then she uses what's called in fear-free, the touch gradient. and what's called gentle control. And so restraint is designed to protect people. Gentle mm-hmm. control is designed to protect the animal. But guess mm-hmm. what? With less is more, you get so many fewer injuries when you learn a proper way of animal handling that doesn't make the animal feel like they're fighting for their life.
Yeah, I believe it. And I bet it's scientifically provable then if you've got this baseline for knowing when animals have trauma, then you must have a baseline for knowing when they're not having trauma.
Well, this is one thing I joke about, Debbie. I hate research. I don't know if I got ADHD or something, but I can't stand to read through. First of all, I don't even understand it. But I'm always headed for the conclusion, right? What's the conclusion?
Right.
If you like the science, then when you go to fearfreepets.com, there's over 300 studies that validate a lot of what we talk about.
Perfect.
And what we do is when we create a course, we have top subject matter experts. So there's 100 boarded veterinary behaviorists in the United States, American College of Veterinary Behaviors, 65 are part of the Fear Free Advisory Group, 12 PhD behaviorists. But we have people like Brian Hare, the head of animal cognition at Duke, Alexander Horowitz, head of animal cognition at Columbia. Although I always speak of the boarded veterinary behaviorists as the bedrock of Fear Free, Temple Grandin is the only gifted person. And one of the things we start to understand, if you like studies, we can tell you why animals like certain colors and certain spectrums of LED lights and substrates for, coefficients of friction for flooring and all sorts of things, ventilation. But Temple was with me one day, and she said the number one fear of all animals is the fear of falling. And the fear of falling is something that they come from birth, right out of the birth canal, the fear of falling. And fear of fire is a learned fear. And that's when I'm starting to understand about when people, whether it's horses or cattle or dogs up on a table, they have to be sure of their footing. If they don't, they're going to have these spikes in fear, anxiety, and stress. It's measurable. And it's kind of the thing now with horses. Before, there were, they don't speak English, right? And their things are with vocalization and with body language. But now, like when you take this course, even people that haven't been that are hobby horse people, or even people that have been around horses their whole life, I guarantee you will learn stuff that you thought, that sound means this, or this movement is a precursor to this. And it's like you've cracked the code on a new language, and it allows you to always take steps to reduce fear, anxiety, and stress and increase happy and calm.
I love that. So I'm hearing you say that anybody, a dog owner, a horse owner, people can learn things through your site too, to be better owners. All right.
Yeah. And and Fear Free Happy Homes has stuff for all species. It's complimentary to all people. There's no charge. It's if you got diarrhea in your cat or a skin issue on your dog, that's not Fear Free. If it's related to your dog is terrified of thunderstorms or fireworks, or there's leash aggression, or your cat goes to the bathroom outside the litter box, or your horse is being preyed upon, or they're cribbing too much, or there's, one of the things that's interesting too, Debbie, there's more enrichment activities in zoos than there are in most homes, farms, or ranches.
And that's really true.
This is what your family has shown. And one of the things it's not just good enough to be physically healthy. You want to be emotionally healthy. And furthermore, there's a genetic exuberance to a horse, to a cow, to a dog, and we want to let them express their genetic exuberance. So now on Almost Heaven Ranch, we have this giant Kong. I'm not sure if they're on the market yet. The founder of Kong and I, Joe Markham, kind of grew up together. He had an 8-foot booth, and he was his only employee at one time, and I met him. And so there's this giant horse Kong that you can stick these treats in.
Uh-huh.
And we have jolly balls. We have those big inflatable balls, and we have those balls with the nets to stick carrots in. And and the horses, it's who'd ever thought we'd have a playground for these horses on Almost Heaven Ranch, but we do.
I love that too. Yeah. And who would think that we shouldn't? I mean, you know, once you know, once the cat's out of the bag, I think people, enrichment is a great word. I know a gal who started, her name is Kane, and she started enrichment programs for some of the big apes, and they're having so much fun. They do a lot of exploratory and everything. And I don't know why anyone, it doesn't matter if flight animal or carnivore, they all like to play. They like to discover. They like to be mentally stimulated and have fun. All those things are not just human. They're very, you know, one God here. You know, we all one share God. Some of these things. Yeah. And so I love that you're leading people in that way and showing that that there's value in that too. You're very progressive, and I love more so that you're leaving this for the next generation too, that you've got a plan in place that this will not just go away with Dr. Becker, but also you've got those people in place, the 12 brainiacs that are going to take us into the future too. And I know Dad, I talked to Dad about the Fear Free, and he would love to be any kind of, just pick up the phone and call him anytime or any kind of counsel that you need about equine. He'll tell you, he'll start off with horses, and then when we get real geeky, he goes right to deer. And then, he'll tell you he's learned everything about horses in the last 10 years from the deer because their flight mechanism is so great, you know.
Debbie, I got to give you a compliment, by the way. First of all, your voice, and I don't say this, everybody that interviews me, your voice sounds like you're a pastor or therapist. You have this really pleasing voice. And you said veterinarian right, which there's six syllables. It is so difficult to say right, but you were absolutely perfect. But I'll give you an idea about enrichment. So now we have 150 acres, soon to have another 100 more, but we have in the wintertime, we'll take an ATV out and take the horse, rather than just throw it down in mangers, we take it out around and put it underneath, because usually there's no snow underneath the trees. Mm-hmm. We live in a forest, and we just, there's a flake here and a flake there and a flake here. So the horses have to go around that big pasture, that fenced pasture, to find their hay. And we do the same thing with grain. We've just got these little shallow kind of bowls. And instead of just giving them their, ameline, you know, and in the bucket in there, and they chomp away for 2 seconds, they actually go out and find it. They like it. I mean, it's, you're not only feeding their body, you're feeding their mind. And one of the things too, anybody that's involved with rescue of dogs or cats or horses, fearfreeshelters.com is a complimentary program for all shelters and rescues, so employees and volunteers. And I think we've had close to 80,000 people complete that online 5-hour course. But what it does, Debbie, it's like what your dad did, what you guys have done. It changes people's relationship with their own dogs, their own cats, their own horses. And now when they're placing them or selling them, whether they're a rescue or they're selling them, they're going to make sure that animal has a happy, healthy, full life. Mm.
You are amazing. You have an amazing website, fearfreepets.com. Google Dr. Marty Becker. You'll go down the rabbit hole. Ha ha. And and I love where you're headed. I love what you're building for all of our animals out there too. And people are going to love you. So I would love to have you back. We should do this semi-regularly here and learn what you're doing. You're way ahead of most of the pack and certainly ahead of me. People go on that website, fearfreepets.com, and find out all the enhancements and all the things they're doing with veterinary professionals, pet owners, and shelters. And Dr. Marty Becker, I love what you're doing. I love what the content you've produced in your life is incredible.
Whisper of the herd. Listen, you don't have to say a word.
It's time for Jamie Jennings to fetch an email from Monty Roberts' inbox and share a morsel of Monty's wisdom in a little segment we like to call Ask Monty.
Leave this world a better place than mine. The magic in the language of the
I attended a 4-day clinic at Flags Up Farms to become familiar with your techniques and have been starting all of our babies successfully now for 6 years. Recently, we have been breeding Irish sport horses in addition to our thoroughbreds, and I've discovered that the ISH Irish sport horse does not have a particularly strong flight instinct. The problem that I now encounter is that all of the babies will exhibit all four signals within a couple of laps around the pen, and usually without even cantering. I can startle them into moving away initially, but it can be difficult to keep them moving without chasing them, which makes them leery of join-up. If I don't chase them, they will join up and follow, but not well because they've exhausted the flight instinct. I've experimented with moving on to saddle, rider, etc. more quickly, but have found that mentally they are not really ready for this either. I believe this is due to the fact that I have a less than successful join-up. Your method has worked really well, and we have produced many lovely riding horses as a result, so we hope that we can transfer this process to our ISH babies with as much success. Monty's answers. I am pleased to hear that these methods are working for you, and especially that you are producing champions. I suppose it's possible that you are worrying about things of lesser importance than you need to. I work with many ISH on my tours, and I find them to be quite normal within the realm of equus. If I have a horse that is exhibiting lower flight tendencies than I am comfortable with, I will often use a plastic shopping bag on a long bamboo cane to increase their flight response. When I feel I have what I want, I simply toss it out over the fence and proceed without the bag. You might try this, but it sounds like you are doing well as it is. It is commendable that you're working to improve your relationship with your horses and understand their nature better. I am certain that as you add numbers to your experience bank, you will look back at this question with a chuckle. The problem you cite is certainly not one of deep concern, but I find it interesting that you place importance on the breed you're working with. Certainly, there are differences as we journey through the many breeds the equine world has to offer. However, it is my opinion that the similarities far outweigh the differences. I find the ISH to be a wonderful breed. They are filled with athletic ability and generosity as well. Because of their heterozygous background, they are blessed with what the geneticists would call hybrid vigor. Without going into a full genetics lesson, let me briefly explain to you that thoroughbreds, Arabs, and other breeds that have existed in a pure form for prolonged periods of time, centuries, have a more consistent gene pool and are termed trending towards homozygous. Geneticists agree that pure forms of any particular breed possess less hybrid vigor than those of a more recent origin, which are more tending towards heterozygous. The warmbloods of the world, including the Irish sport horse, are the result of recent outcrosses to the mix of bloodlines of the cooler draft breeds with those of established thoroughbreds. These horses tend to have a more vigorous physiology. They will generally have healthier feet and stronger bones than the older breeds. They also tend to have more laid-back attitudes. Physiologically as well as physically, they are generally less fragile than their purebred cousins. The ISH Irish Sport Horse is extremely intelligent and highly trainable, and if we get it right with these horses, they will become exceptionally gentle and often great mounts for the children of the horse world. I encourage you to continue your work with your ISH and believe that you will ultimately return to me with reports of great successes.
For more of these insights into good horsemanship, go to MontyRoberts.com and click on the words Ask Monty at the bottom of the page.
Where in the world is Monty Roberts?
Monty is looking forward to meeting some new friends, two-legged and four-legged. We are going to focus today because we're in the middle of the advanced course here now as we record, and it's been so fascinating. We've got BLM Mustangs, we've got Grade Mustangs, we have Arabians right out of the fields. We've got all kinds of crazy stuff going. So let me focus today on the calendar. I want everybody to look. This is your last chance to go look at the Movement. We have just a few tickets left. That's June 17 through 19, the Movement 2022. And you can go on MontyRoberts.com and click on the tab that says Movement and find out all about that. And Jen will be there. So you have to be there with us. And lots of actually Horse Radio Network hosts are crawling out of the corners. It'll be really fun. And then we have a sold out clinic, but I'm going to put it in here anyway because I want people to get on the wait list. I don't want anybody to miss it. So June 20 and 21 is the Mountain Trail Clinic with Mark Bolander, the designer of the trail. And Monty Roberts is the reason for being because we put it in his infield and he went
this is good. And so we're really excited about that. And how can people find it?
There we go. You can find all of that and more at MontyRoberts.com. By the way, can people sign up to audit the clinic on June 20 and 21?
Well, interesting you should ask that, because people have said, can we come and watch? If you have a ticket to the movement and you want to stay and watch for that, yes.
So
if not,
that can be basically included in your ticket to the movement. Okay.
It kind of is, because on the 19th, I should explain that June 17 and 18 is our more, it's more like we've done the movement in the past. We have these amazing demonstrations of gentling and coming to the mounting block. You know, Jamie Jennings is ASPCA Trainer of the Year is going to be there teaching with Monty. And it is, we are unique, but it is more like you'd imagine a clinic would be. But our variation this year is on the 19th, which is Sunday, which is private sessions. So everybody got a chance to either bring their own horse and work with one of the presenters, or more than one of the presenters with their own horse. Or if they're coming from a distance or don't have a horse right now, they can use our transition horses, our horses that are going through the adoption retraining process to be adopted.
Oh, so you get to get horsehair on your hands. Yoo-hoo!
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Us horse girls were like, you know what? It's just so hard to sit there on your hands for 2 days and watch all this beautiful horse work done and not be inspired to go, you know, stay there.
Right,
and yeah, do it right away. So Sunday is set up and it's all but sold out, I think, now too. But if you have a ticket to the movement, you can stay and watch the private sessions, whether you're signed up for one or not. And you can stay and watch Mark in part. And he starts in hand, as we've might have mentioned in earlier episodes, but he starts everybody in hand. I don't care if you want an Olympic gold. You start in hand with your horse because he wants to take you through the backing up and the partnership on the ground with the horse long before you meet the trail. So we spend a little bit of time doing that, and he assesses people's abilities at that point too, the horse's behaviors, all those things. And then we go into the mountain trail and we start in hand on each obstacle, starting with a more complicated angle at each obstacle, and seeing where the horse is and backing it up and getting their feet wet and, you know, all those fun things between a suspension bridge and a big pond with a mounting block rock in the middle of it. And all this
stuff
is really fun. Oh, it's really
fun. It's basically the Grand Tetons in the infield of a race.
Yeah. That's a great way.
Yeah,
really, without the snow.
Yeah. Without the snow. And you can find all of that, as I said, at MontyRoberts.com. You can also get lots of information by calling Flag Is Up Farms. That's right. There's nice people there who can answer your questions. 805-688-6288 is where you can find them. And you can go to MontyRoberts.com and find that phone number. So it's all easy. And for details about today's show, you can go to horsemanshipradio.com, where you will find links, photos, and more information about today's guests and topics. We love your feedback. A great place to give us feedback, as well as follow along with all the fun at Flag Is Up Farms. Say that three times fast.
You did.
Facebook.com/Monty Roberts. Monty Roberts is the official page with a little blue check mark. And his account on Twitter as well as Instagram is Monty_Roberts. And thank you very much to our title sponsor, who is
Hands On Gloves. Absolutely. And I'm actually trying to talk Jay into coming. I'm going to shame him now. Coming out from Texas to see the movement, too. I'm really excited about that. You know what I should say, too? People should go to Facebook right now. We just put up a post. So if this is coming out June 1, it'll still be discoverable. And it's a time lapse. It's a 60-second time lapse of the 5 days we put the mountain trail together.
Oh,
so you get to watch in 60 seconds go from a field of grass to the Tetons. Yeah.
Neat. So there you go. You go, and that's on Facebook, right?
Yeah. I put that up on Facebook today. It's actually on our YouTube channel too. So Monty has a YouTube channel too.
It's probably even easier to find on your YouTube channel.
It probably is. Actually, that's the second greatest search engine, I guess, because it's owned by Google, of course.
There you go. So on Facebook, on YouTube, what is the channel's name? What do they look up?
It's called Monty Channel.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, YouTube. Search Monty and Mountain Trail. Maybe I haven't done that yet because we just put it up. But it's really fun. We had Wayne did it for us. Our videographer, Wayne, and his wife, Janine, do all our video work, and they're amazing. And they do it for our uni, too. So one of our sponsors is MontyRobertsUniversity.com. People can go there and see their handiwork. They're amazing with the deer and the horses and Monty, and they handle us all well. So, and be sure to visit all the other great shows, too, on the Horse Radio Network at HorseRadioNetwork.com. And until next time, have many happy horse hours.